Most bankers aren't ready to help you until after their third cup of coffee. But with Central National Bank's after-hours service, you don't have to wait for the bank lobby to open to get help. You can contact us from 6 to 8:30 in the morning or from 5 to 10 in the evening, and we'll connect you to a real, live, local person who can answer questions and fix problems 7 days a week. Bank different. Bank Central. Central National Bank. Member FDIC.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This is a Rogue Media Network podcast. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Are you drained, bursting with energy? It's at this level because maybe you don't have enough boundaries, less social in the winter. There can be many reasons. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you just need some more time alone. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself, and it isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/365 today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/365.
This is 365 Sports, powered by Sikkim365.com.
Amanda Kristovic joins us, front office sports, with us on 365 Sports. Amanda, thanks for your time. Paul Catalina and David Smoke, glad to have you with us. So the last, just what, 15, 30 minutes ago, the story about Notre Dame and unfair labor practices. Can you update us a little bit on that? Thanks for your time again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Well, yeah, it's been quite an interesting half an hour. So Notre Dame is now the subject of the latest National Labor Relations Board charge, as you just mentioned. And before I explain, I just want to say that Notre Dame, none of the athletes at Notre Dame have filed this charge. It could be filed. The weird thing about the NLRB is these charges can be filed by literally anyone. So this charge was filed by a former Minnesota regent named Michael Hsu, who's been filing a lot of these cases. He filed one against Northwestern. He filed one against the entire Ivy League. And I can get into why he picked Notre Dame as his next target, but he literally just filed 30 minutes ago and told me that he's hoping to get the case kicked off, and figured out before the presidential election, because if you don't know, the NLRB is contingent upon each presidential administration. So the election in November could change everything.
Amanda, these cases that keep popping up and are keep getting more complicated for the NCAA, what do you see as the most reasonable shortest path to an end game for both sides here, so that we don't keep getting, like the NCAA, you tweeted this out today very well, is that they said, look, we got all these new transfer rules. Well, you didn't come up with those on your own. Like, you were made to do it. It's exactly. Going to be the same way with all this other stuff. What is the shortest path to a resolution here?
Well, the shortest path to a resolution is, like, also the most ironic one, which is to collectively bargain with the athletes. And it's ironic because it's the thing that the NCAA and its schools are fighting so hard in the courts, at the National Labor Relations Board, in Congress, against. They, because collective bargaining requires employee status, and they just, like, don't want to do that. I can get into the reasons why, but like the transfer portal is the number one example of how collective bargaining would fix every single issue. Because if you have a CBA, if you have, you know, a union that negotiates with the league as it's done in the pros, you don't have unrestricted free agency in the pros. The reason? There's a CBA that prevents that, right? The players and the teams and the league have all agreed on rules governing who can be traded, who can be a free agent, when, and in many cases, how much they can be paid, right? That's only legal if you have a CBA, an antitrust exemption, et cetera. So it's funny that the NCAA is so against collective bargaining when that would immediately solve all of these issues around the transfer portal and NIL.
Well, we know they're not very smart, because if it was, if they would have just come to their senses 10, 15, 20 years ago, we wouldn't be here today, would we?
No, definitely not. I mean, just look at NIL. I mean, there was a federal court case centering around UCLA basketball player Ed O'Bannon. Mm-hmm. You know, in 2014, that was decided that, like, hey, you can't profit off of a player's name, image, and likeness unless, you know, that player also has the right to do so. And, you know, he was in a video game. He didn't get that right. That court case came down, like, I don't know, 7 years before the NCAA finally changed its tune on NIL. That's just an example of how late they are. You know, I mean, they literally didn't even hand down an interim NIL policy until the day before the first law governing NIL in Florida was supposed to go into effect. I remember I was covering it. I was like sitting there on my couch, like waiting. Like we were like, when is this coming? Because the NCAA had to concede, and they dragged their feet on every single one of these things, and the transfer rules that they're talking about now, same thing. They were dragging their feet on it. This court decision came out 3-4 months ago, and now they're talking about, oh, yeah, we're going to allow kids to transfer more than once and not have to sit out. Well, they've been doing that for the past 4 months.
Yeah, it's nuts. And you're right, Paul, the tweet she had earlier. Let's make this clear. This is not anything new. This is not news.
No,
because, right. Yeah.
Amanda, I was when we were at the Super Bowl in Vegas. I was hanging out with a buddy of mine, and you know we were talking about NIL, and he's a USC booster, and he said, you know what's weird is that, you know, had they let them do this for like $2,000 to $3,000 a month, right now we'd be talking about maybe $4,000 or $5,000 a month for most athletes, and not, you know, $120,000 a year. No one would have said a word.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's interesting. I guess
we're talking about a decade or so ago. Had they just said, "Yeah, here we're going to give you $2,500 a month," and people would be like, "All right, great, you know, it's more than I'm making right now." You know, most of the athletes have been like, "This is awesome, I'm making money." But now, like that, the wool's been pulled back, and we've got this French Revolution style battle going on here. Mm-hmm. Like, it's going to cost way more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Johnson case, which has been like stalled for a year, is a good example of this, because that is a federal case in the Third Circuit. It's basically just saying that Division I athletes should be considered employees and therefore allowed to be paid hourly minimum wage. So, yeah, I guess you're right. It's like these players, if they were given employee status and, you know, minimum wage, like maybe some of them would have been trying to bargain for more. They would have, you know, just like other student workers do on campuses, formed a union and tried to, increase their salaries. But, I mean, there's definitely something to be said for that, that if you had just given the employee status or some sort of framework for modest employment, that, you know, we wouldn't be having these issues.
Amanda, I watched a podcast that you were a part of, and I'm going to tell the story. How did you and when did you start covering sports business or college athletics? Because we started our show. We've all been in broadcasting for a long time, but we started this show into the teeth of COVID in the spring of 2020. Did you not start basically your career doing the same thing with what you do?
Yeah, I mean, literally the same time frame. I actually was finishing graduate school for journalism in 2020. And I finished that program and graduated from a couch in May of 2020. As graduation was approaching, all of my fellow students and I, none of us had jobs, especially those of us who were interested in sports. And I just started to notice that, like, the only stories that were being told about sports in the middle of COVID were about the fact that A, obviously the players who were getting COVID, but B, all the shutdowns and all the fact that there was no money. So I was like, well, if I need a job, I better figure out how to write about the money behind sports. And I was very lucky to land this job at FOS after a few months of employment. And they were like, hey, there's this like NIL thing coming up. There's this college sports. Like, we don't really have anyone to write about that. Like, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, I think so. Like, I went to Georgetown, suffering basketball program these days, but like, I know what's going on. And here we are almost 4 years later. And it has been probably the wildest beat outside of sports betting in American sports.
No question. No question. One of the things that you also, I believe, mentioned was that one of the first stories that popped was, and this seems like it's been 30 years because of so many things that have happened since about the time we started this YouTube show, and also you began your career and you've done a great job. Paul, remember when the Big Ten and Pac-12 decided to shut down their conferences yeah. because of this thing, COVID?
Yeah.
That does seem to me like, oh, that did happen, didn't it? And like, so much has happened since then. It's incredible, the wave of what we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, that feels like 15 lifetimes ago, even though it was only a few years ago. And I remember that happened like 3 weeks into me getting this job. So I was like, I was like Googling who the PR people were for the Pac-12 and the Big Ten. And I was like begging them to add me to the Zoom press conferences at the time. I mean, it was wild. It was baptism by fire, to say the least.
What do you think David Baker has done well in his short tenure as the NCAA president?
That's a good question. I think what he's done well is acknowledge the issues. I'm just going to preface this. I've spoken with him a few times. This is not based on private conversations I've had with him. This is just my basic opinion and assessment. But like, I think he walked into that job and was like, amateurism, multi-billion-dollar industry, but the players don't get paid. Like, we're talking about cheeseburgers, but not giving them better health care. Like, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. Like, what are our priorities are like all wrong? And why are we so opposed to making basic changes that everyone agrees with? And I think like that's what he was trying to do with this Project D1 proposal by saying, hey, guys, we should come up with a way to, quote unquote, address the elephant in the room. He literally said that we should talk about the fact that some of the schools, a small number, but some of the schools in the NCAA, you know, bring in $200 million a year, and the players, even with their scholarships and cost of attendance, don't get half of that. So what are we doing here? Like, we need to give them some more money, right? And everyone lost their minds. Right? Like, so I think Charlie sees the issues. And I think he's a lot more, I don't want to say radical, but progressive than at least his predecessor. He just, you know, he's restrained by the limitations of his role. He's restrained by his members. And most importantly, he's restrained by his lawyers.
Amanda, what do you think about the FSU, ACC? And that's a smoldering fire. It might be a volcano, and maybe at times there's an eruption or two. In the end, who's going to win there?
Oh, that's such a good question, and I'm glad you asked because I can plug my feature that's coming out this weekend.
There we go. I did not know that, but I'm glad. That was a question. I was asked about that on the chat room, by the way. Now, a lot of people love what we have had so far with this segment with you, so I'm glad I asked that question.
Yeah, so So I'm going to have a feature on the Front Office Sports website and in our newsletter this weekend breaking down the FSU-ACC lawsuit and counter-lawsuit and the Clemson lawsuit and counter-lawsuit. I mean, look, that's like a contractual dispute, right? Like, the idea there is FSU is trying to say that the contract that binds the ACC together is illegal, that it's not enforceable. Because if it is enforceable, then when FSU wants to leave the ACC, which if you haven't been paying attention, they've wanted to do for a while, and go to the SEC, although they haven't gotten an invitation to the SEC, as far as anyone knows, they'd have to pay like close to $600 million, right? And Clemson is having the similar issue. I don't know who's going to win in that dispute. There is a hearing on Monday to dismiss the FSU versus ACC case, though the ACC versus FSU case is definitely, at least for now, proceeding in another state. But what I will say is that conference realignment hasn't really had a lot of litigation, right? And I find it very difficult to see how the ACC could, like, take this all the way to, like, a business trial. I mean, at a certain point, right? Like, you can't force your partner to stay if they really, really, really don't want to stay. At a certain point, you just gotta sign the divorce papers. So that's what I like in this too.
Do you think that we will ever see any kind of real discovery in this case? Because to me, if you're ESPN, the ACC, or even these two schools, as much as Clemson and Florida State may be willing to say, damn the torpedoes, we don't care what comes out, some of it might make them look stupid too.
Yeah, I mean, look, nobody in college sports wants discovery. No one in sports wants discovery, period. And so I think that that's a big threat. Like I said, there's an opportunity in at least one of the lawsuits for negotiated, some sort of resolution. But it's like, I don't really see what that looks like, because right now the ACC's position is no, you're staying unless you want to pay $500 million. Mm-hmm. And FSU's position is like, no, we're leaving and we're not paying $500 million. Kind of incompatible, right? Mm-hmm. So at this point, they may have to go through discovery. But no, certainly none of them want to go through discovery. And ESPN filed a brief that you are probably alluding to. They hired one of the, fanciest law firms here in New York City to represent them, to say, hey, no matter how this dispute is settled, just don't publish the terms of our contract because it's a trade secret. So they don't want discovery either, because they want everything, to be under seal and under wraps. And, as a private corporation, they have the right to request that.
Where do you see college athletics, or is it possible to see where college athletics and the landscape will be in 3 years?
I think there is going to be a ruling that requires collective bargaining and or an employment model in the next 1 to 5. The determining fact, there are two determining factors, right? Determining factor one is whichever case makes a decision like that first, how long does the appeals process take? Decision factor number two is whether or not the NCAA's multimillion-dollar lobbying campaign in Congress can, kind of like throw a Hail Mary and get Congress to pass a law that would supersede all these lawsuits and like basically codify amateurism and put into U.S. law that college athletes are not considered employees. But I mean, that's like the Hail Mary of all Hail Marys, unless we have a completely conservative, government come next January. So, if I were a betting person, I would say like by the end of 5 years from now, we're going to see an employment model.
By the way, Amanda Kristovich with us, Front Office Sports, our guest, and a lot of you have loved this segment, Paul.
Yeah. House versus NCAA. Do you think that one's going to get settled?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Which surprises me, because the NCAA never settles these sorts of cases, because even though there are settlements, there, I'm not a lawyer, but like there are ways to like create a settlement that isn't an admission of guilt. The NCAA usually wants to take these all the way to trial and like win so that they don't have to change their amateurism rules. But like the $5 billion damages price tag is like way too high. And ultimately, this isn't about employment. It's about whether or not athletes should get a cut of broadcast revenue deeming that NIL. So I think I think they've sort of conceded that it's worth settling.
All right. I know you've covered, and we appreciate your time. I hope you don't mind a couple more questions. Caitlin Clark, yeah, the impact she's had, the numbers, the ratings, even the WNBA draft, which used to be, it kind of came and went, about to sign that crazy, not crazy in a negative way, but the amazing endorsement with Nike. Is this going to be Caitlin Clark, or is this about to be a surge where you think it's more than Caitlin Clark when it comes to women's basketball?
Oh, I think it's more than Caitlin Clark. So I've been covering the structural gender inequities in, let's just start with NCAA women's basketball, right, since 2021. And what I've learned is that the quality of women's basketball, of course, it's improved, but over the years, but there have always been stars. There have always been huge personalities. There have always been, you know, players like Diana Taurasi, who in the bubble in the WNBA in 2021 or 2020, whenever it was, like, told a referee, like, I'll see you in the lobby later. I don't know if you guys, like, remember that, but it was like, and the referee looked like, you know, like she became white as a ghost. So basically, what I'm saying is there have always been these huge personalities. There's just not been visibility, access to these teams, these players, and even the games. So I think Caitlin Clark has brought a lot of people in, but I think there could have been a Caitlin Clark 10 years ago if the inequities that have since been at least like partially improved upon didn't exist back then.
Amanda, one thing on that follow-up. So we know that the WNBA salaries are there because of the way they are, because of the revenue that they bring in compared to, for example, the NBA, which is like a billion or so. Is that the only way then with the access or the visibility that they could ever raise it? Because you just don't raise it because everyone wants them to have better salaries, right?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Thank you.
Because, like, from a corporate standpoint, the obvious answer is no, right? But look at what U.S. soccer did with the men's and women's national teams. Part of the reason the women's national team wasn't getting equal pay for playing in the World Cup was because the World Cup as an entity, right, not the U.S. Soccer Federation, like the World Cup gives unequal prize money between, mm-hmm. for the men and the women, right? So U.S. Soccer in its equal pay fight ended up agreeing, and the men's team ended up agreeing to sharing their larger prize money with the women so that they all got paid for the equal amount of work. That doesn't mean that more money necessary. I mean, yes, the Women's World Cup, there's a whole thing about their broadcast rights and they're like making more money now and they're going to make more money. But like that was a decision that was sort of negotiated with the men's team, with collective bargaining with U.S. Soccer. And it wasn't necessarily about revenue. So, like, there is precedent for, you know, sharing the revenue across the genders. It's just a question of, you know, I mean, look, obviously the NBA and the WNBA are different businesses from U.S. soccer. But it's a possibility.
You know, I appreciate you. And I'm serious. We have incredible guests from around the country that do a lot of things. But a lot of people really have appreciated your segment. I have. Paul has. And all of us have. Garrett, who runs the show, thanks for your time. I told you, I said this to Jenna Bardal from TheAthletic.com we had on earlier this week for the first time. Thank you. Block my number because we will be back in touch bothering you for more and more segments. I'm not kidding. Paul, am I kidding?
Oh, no. You're part of it now. So
thank you very much.
Bother me anytime.
You were great. You were fantastic. Amanda Kristovich with Front Office Sports, which is a great website covering sports in many different angles. Appreciate her time.
This has been a Rogue Media Network production. Sports Show.